What's next for IT? In today's economy, technology touches every aspect of the day-to-day operations of business. There has never been more pressure on IT to deliver for our organizations. So what can we expect over the next decade? We need to think differently about how we approach our work to continue to thrive into the future. This requires all of us to be intentional in how we look at our role going forward. Smart IT is an approach to getting the important things done by transforming the way we think, work, and lead. And now, let's disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk the smart IT way. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. And today, I'm welcoming Mike to the show. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, William. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. With everything going on in the world, Mike, I'm really, really excited to talk to you. I just love what you've been doing in your career and your profession. So I'm excited to chat with you this morning.
Thank you. And it's great to be on your show. Thank you very much.
Well, I just have a real passion for risk management, you know, holistically. And I always feel for business stakeholders when they have to like deal with so many things coming on onto their plate. So if we just take something out of the news, we're thinking about tariffs and we're post-pandemic and return to work, offshoring. I mean, there's a lot of things on CEOs, CTOs, CFOs plate. And one of the big things is obviously cybersecurity.
Yeah.
That along with just operationally making sure all of our digital infrastructure stays up and running. So that's a lot to deal with.
It is.
Yeah, so let's just start there, kind of a macro level. So you're in the shoe of, you're a CEO right now, but even a mid-size or enterprise company, and you got all this stuff coming to you. Just get you a broad feeling of how do you handle all this.
Right. So there's a number of things here, right? At an operational level, people like CISOs, the big challenge they face is too many false positives, right? They've got all of these tools that are flagging up all kinds of problems, and they've got very limited staff. And frankly, in the economic direction that we're going, it's likely to be even fewer staff, right? So they need to focus their effort, right? And often some of these tools are less helpful than they should be, even, and I can talk more about this later, but the advent of AI in some ways has made this worse because it's adding more false positives to deal with rather than make it less, right? And on the other hand, you know, basically budgets are very constrained, so they're trying to figure out what to do. At the same time, organizations that are selling security products are all trying to sell to the CISO, right? So this poor person, you know, the security teams are being hit from all sides, right? They're being hit by internal demands. The tools that they have are causing them to run around like crazy. And their external vendors are all trying to upsell them or sell new things to them, right? So it's a pretty hard time for them. And frankly, it's likely to get worse over the next few months.
Yeah, and I always kind of tell people when we talk about risk management, holistically, it's always, at the end of the day, an embedded business function.
Yes.
So we have to prioritize what we need to do with finite resources. So I know technology leaders sometimes don't necessarily get that context. So we talked about buying tooling and asking for more money, but their colleagues in marketing and product development and services all would like additional dollars as well. So let's talk about this professional prioritization.
Yes. So it's difficult, right? That you know, a company has to look, bear in mind that cybersecurity is a cost, right? All of these things are a cost and there's no revenue associated with it. So now you're competing for the same dollars, right? As you said, the marketing budget, which is associated with actually revenue, right? That's the positive thing for them. Other departments like compliance and whatever are also asking for money as well. The problem is that if a security team is actually on the ball and there's been no problems, right, then it's easy to say, well, we can afford to go and cut there a little bit, right? Because there's we're not seeing any problems. So it's some way of showing, companies need some way of showing the productivity of what they're doing, right, and the investments that they're making. For example, if you're a company and you want to reduce the risk of ransomware, right, if you've had no ransomware attacks, right, the question is whether right now is the good time to be asking for several thousand dollars to go and buy an anti-ransomware tool that you know, when you haven't had a ransomware attack. So that you know, it is difficult, right? And it is about this issue of risk management as well. And again, I think for CISOs, they need to focus on somehow focus their resources. I've heard stories of CISOs, they're being told that there are all these critical alerts on their systems, right? High-level CVEs. But some of these systems are not doing business critical things. So it's a mix. Even if you're told that there's some very hypercritical CVE that you need to patch urgently, it might be on a system that really isn't doing very much and you can afford to wait. So there's two things. It's what's coming from outside and what's coming from inside. And it is a very difficult balance.
Yeah, that's interesting too. So if I get a request for a dollar from four different departments.
Yeah.
And one department says everything looking good and my current investments are
yes.
doing this job. And then the second one's like, well, we're not performing as well. So maybe this extra dollar investment could help.
Yeah.
And the other two are like, well, it's kind of in the middle there. So I'm thinking about this decision maker. They got a lot of business justification processes in there. They forgot what to say yes or no to. I know a lot of people in the industry now are looking at a better way to actually communicate what these investments are doing from a
Yeah.
technology standpoint and cyber. So and I know when this is one of your passions, right? Let's get away from qualitatively saying something bad might be happening and we're doing okay. Give me X amount of dollars to maybe we should start quantifying and expressing what the level of risk is to help make that decision a little bit more easier for business decision makers. So let's start talking about this field here
yeah.
of risk quantification here.
Yeah. So the basic idea of risk quantification is you're putting a dollar value on the risk, right? And it isn't just $1 value, it's a distribution. So if you take the risk of ransomware, right? Well, there are a whole series of costs associated with a successful ransomware attack, right? There's legal costs, there's cost to patching systems, and the list goes on and on. You could probably sit down for half an hour and have a fun time writing down all the different, cost categories, right? And then at the same time, you've got, what's your risk of having a ransomware attack, right? So if you can take those pieces of information, right, the costs of a ransomware attack and the risk, you can run an analysis giving you your risk exposure, right? So the idea might be, it's like an insurance policy, right? What's the risk of the house burning down? Well, it might be once every 10 years, you might expect an incident, right? And that's okay. But next year, you've got like a 10% chance. So you can take like the total cost and then notionally split it over 10 years and understand what kind of coverage you need. This is the same thing with risk quantification as well. You can look at your risk, how much risk you're running, and then make a decision about how you can cope with that risk, right? Either to buy insurance or to buy tools to reduce the risk or maybe some combination. But without understanding the magnitude of the risk, it's very difficult to make those informed decisions about what to do.
And I think a lot of IT leaders are really gravitating towards that business value, right? So it went from $1 million investment request for getting better in security or less risk or less exposure to maybe my current risk is $1 to $5 million exposure over the next year, and $500,000 investment could bring that down. That kind of changed the nature of that company.
That is, right? So you could say, well, like currently my risk of a ransomware attack is whatever proportion, and if it happens, it will be X amount of dollars. Whereas if I buy this new tool, right, my risk of ransomware attack goes down substantially, and even if it does happen, right, then the costs go down. So you can make a reasoned argument for having for buying whatever tool it is that you're looking at. Right. So the whole point is that you take it away from, finger in the air judgments to something much more based on a realistic assessment of the risk that an organization's running and the consequences of something bad happening. Right. So it's the same kind of a process that people go through for buying insurance as well. Right. Even at the personal level. Right. If you buy life insurance, you think about, what your dependents need and, the risks that you're currently running. Buy the appropriate policy, right? And businesses do the same thing when they're off buying fire insurance or other types of insurance as well, right? You've got a trade-off. So that's what risk quantification is about. It doesn't have to be cyber, actually. The same kind of techniques could be applied to basically any kind of risk that the business runs. But it's at least my experience has been on the cyber risk side.
Well, that leads into a very good pathway here because there's a lot of discussion about improving the alignment of cybersecurity programs and enterprise risk management programs themselves.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of time, even at ERM, they have a lot of qualitative
scoring and methodologies, and they may be looking over and say, hey, what's this CRQ? What's this sub-risk quantity? This looks interesting. So let's go back to what you just mentioned, right? So maybe it's only, we're talking about ransomware, but also maybe we should make this investment overseas in this endeavor, or maybe we should do something from a physical safety standpoint. Let's start talking about 3, 4, 5 different decisions on your plate and how risk quantification might be able to help out benefits versus risk.
So it's not just ransomware, right? At least on the cyber side, right? There's risk of business interruption. There's risk of this, that, and the other, right? Risk of data breach, right? And, you know, how do you recover from that? Included in these things is, you know, if you're dealing with customers and you've got social security numbers and credit card numbers, then you may well have to be paying for credit monitoring as well. So there's a whole bunch of risks that go with this, right? A whole bunch of payouts potentially. So then once you can start quantifying that, you can put in the appropriate level of investment. And that same methodology, right, of quantifying risk, as you said, could be applied elsewhere to other techniques if other areas of risk, if that's, you know, what you need to do. To do this, I mean, you can, I have seen people try and do cyber risk quantification on spreadsheets. It's really not an appropriate thing to do on the spreadsheet. And the reason is that they just don't have the mathematical techniques that you need, right, to do it. I've seen people do it in R or Python, and that would work very well, right? Those languages definitely have the facilities. Or you could go and buy something from one of the vendors that are out there. Either way, you could do it. If you do it yourself, then, you know, the maths is fairly intensive. You would need at least the equivalent of a second or third year level of understanding from a math focused degree. That's the level that you'd need to do it yourself. You know, it is fairly complicated. The underlying statistical ideas are a bit complicated. So if you don't have people like that on staff, then I would suggest that you buy a tool, one of the tools in the market, and go through their process to quantify the risk.
Yeah, and then there's some suggestions when people go out there shopping, right? So I think some people over rely on the tool, so they're not exactly sure what the inputs going to this tool are, don't know what the modeling and the analysis rigor is behind the scenes. And then some are a little confused on the outputs. So let's start talking about, you know, understanding your organization first, inputs, outputs. So when you start going to shopping on the marketplace, what are you looking for a solution? Right.
Yeah, so I mean, ease of use is a very good point, right? I mean, as I said, the math can be a little bit heavy duty, right? But you know, there's no reason for your organization to have to do that if you don't want, right? That's why you buy a tool to do it for you. So it's like ease of use. So what I would start with is making some reasonable assumptions about your organization, right? Now, your total liability, if something happens, it can't really be any bigger than the value of the company. Right. So for example, if your company's valued at 100 million, right, then you know, there's no point at all giving you losses of 200 or 300 million because the company's only worth 200. Right. So what I would suggest is, as you start off, make some credible assumptions and test out the product, whatever product you select gives you some credible answers, right? And again, if it's telling you that your risks are crazy, hundreds of millions, when the company's only worth much less, then you know that something's gone wrong, either in the tool or your handling of it. The other thing I would suggest that you do is take some test cases where you know the answer, right?
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so what you can do, there are several places online where you can do this. Go and take two risks, right? Two risks where you have them completely characterized, and you know what the answer should be, and you put those into the tool and you see what comes back. Now, if all goes well, it should give you the expected result, right? And then that tells you that the tool is using a fairly sound methodology, that the calculations underneath are good, and you're good to go. So let's recap on that. You should really understand your business. You should understand the test cases, the scenarios that you want to look at: ransomware, business interruption, data breach. Maybe there's some other pieces, maybe some employee actions, right? Disgruntled employee actions and so on. You consider those test cases, build up on maybe a sheet of paper what you would expect the risks to be, and then go through that modeling process with the tool and have a look at what the results come back as, right? Now, In some cases, they'll tell you some things that you didn't know, and that's good. In other cases, they might tell you things which are not sensible, and you can make a judgment about the value of the tool in those cases.
Yeah, and I want to hit home on that point, right? Validating that the output is credible. I used to see this early on, people run these loss scenarios, and these numbers are so large. It seems like how's anybody in business? It just wasn't sound, right?
So that's a very good point, right? So I'm going to get into a tiny, tiny little bit of math, right? Because it'll explain what you're seeing and what you need to see as a result. Look, let's imagine that you have two losses, two different scenarios, and the loss range is from 1 million to 10 million for both of them, right? And there's some probability of both of those losses or those losses happening. The way that the math works is that there's some maybe very minuscule probability of both losses happening at the $10 million level. So it gives you a $20 million result as the maximum. But the probability associated with that is tiny, right? And depending on how you do the maths, that might be just absolutely a tiny loss, whereas the most likely value might actually only be 2 million, right? Or something less. So that's why you need the distribution of results, not just the single numbers, right? And to say that the maximum, and you will out of these processes get some very, very high numbers for the maximum loss, but the probability of the maximum loss happening is really, really small. So what you should be more focused on is the mean value, often called the expected value as well, and then the shape of the distribution, right? So these things will have a loss distribution that will go maybe something like that, with a very, very long tail off to the right-hand side. What that long tail is on the right-hand side is often neither here nor there, because the probability of it happening is so low. And in some cases, it's so low, it's like more likely, more likely that your little green men will land, right? Frankly, than these things will happen, right? But the tools may well spit that out. So don't focus on the maximum loss. Focus on the distribution. Focus on the mean value that you would expect to see. And as I said, the distribution gives you a view of how that probability distribution is. And it will give you a sense of, well, is it more focused towards the lower end risk or the higher end risk? In most cases, it will be focused towards the lower end risk. So again, those outliers, those really high maximum values, don't pay too much attention to them. They are very, very unlikely to happen.
And that's, I thought we found that interesting because people love the outliers, right?
Yeah.
The sensational. And it's interesting, like some areas might have a probability of a storm wiping through the city for 1 in 100 years.
Yeah.
So we had a city that had that experience. That 2 years later, they had another big weather event that was also 1 in 100 years. And then a year later, they had a third weather event that was 1 in 500 years.
Right.
So it started to skew people's opinions now, like, oh my God, this happens so often, when in fact it still was very unlikely for all of these three events to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're pointing to a phenomena where people are using the wrong distribution to model the risk, right? And a lot of people end up using what's called the normal distribution, right? Which is the bell curve, right? This is all in all the introductory textbooks. You see this bell curve, right? Or also called the Gaussian or the normal. It's got three different names, right? Yeah. But everybody knows what it looks like. And because everybody knows what it looks like and it's covered in most introductory courses, people assume that their risk distribution looks like a bell curve. But in a number of cases, it doesn't, right? And you're right that in this case of the natural disasters, it doesn't look like that. The real risk is not distributed what we call normally. Same thing in the financial markets as well, right? And I thought you were going to give an example for the financial markets where these things are called black swan events, and you get like a number of these things. Oh, well, this is a once in 100-year event followed by a once in a 500-year event and so on. And the reason why these things are wrong is because the models have used the wrong distribution, right? So, which takes us into, if you're modeling risk, then you've got to use what the correct distribution is. And that's one of the problems with this type of analysis, right? That people really don't know what the risk distribution of ransomware is or a data breach or business interruption. They just don't know. So we're kind of, to some extent, guessing what it will be, right? And so long as you don't believe that these numbers are completely unchallengeable, really realistically what these tools will put out for you is a best guess, right? It's a best guess of what the future looks like given the limited information that we have. I think realistically what it is saying it's better than nothing, but don't expect this to be a perfect representation of the world. In your example where the hurricanes come through, right, you could model the risk and say, well, it's this amount, right? But it gives you a sense of, you know, how much insurance you should buy and what you should do, right? The fact that the reality turned out to be worse, well, okay, that's a problem, but it does indicate that maybe you should spend more than you were spending. And the alternative is not to make any estimates at all, and in which case you'll probably underprepare anyway. So some level of understanding is better than none. And I think with all of these things, you know, you can't expect it to be perfect, right? Because the unknowns that go into these calculations are so high. It's a way of getting into the ballpark is what I would say.
Yeah, and that's important for decision makers because that's just a couple of scenarios we just mentioned, right? So
yeah.
Across the enterprise, they're looking at a whole bunch of things that could go wrong every day.
Yeah.
Something with the credit risk, something with they don't have enough cash to make payroll. Yeah. I mean, it's just so many across. And then if you ran these scenarios across the board, you could freak out. But what I like is the fact that business people, CEOs, CTOs, CFOs are used to this level of uncertainty. They understand the tails. They do a very, very good job of managing it. And they seem a lot more sane sometimes than some of our counterparts in the technology side of the house.
Well, they do, right? So bear in mind, if you're an accountant, right, part of your training is to do things like an allowance for doubtful accounts, right? Or, you know, which is basically people who don't pay up. You also have other accounting allowances as well, right? So in terms of revenue recognition, for example, somebody might do a deal with you and not pay up, right? Or there might be theft or other things as well. So there's a whole bunch of these accounting estimates that people use. And you're right that the accountants are trained to use this and they understand what they are. It's on the IT side. I think because when people use computers, you know, IT people, they're used to certainty, right? It either fails or it doesn't. Whereas this is much more of a gray area, right? Where the kind of you're running, there's a distribution of losses, right? And it's something that I think a lot of IT people aren't very comfortable with, right? So for all of these things, if you can make an estimate of what it is, right, don't worry about whether it's, you know, precise to the second or third decimal place, but just give it as a ballpark figure and then look at the distribution, which is what you were saying, right? Look at the distribution that you end up with and then think about whether you're comfortable with that distribution or not and how you might change the shape of it. So it might change the shape of it by buying different tools, or it might be that you're perfectly comfortable with where you are, right? There's enough reserves to deal with the situation. At least you'll have some way of knowing and some insight into what the risk is.
And I started to get into almost like the appetite for risk and being comfortable with this. Because it could turn out something got worse, but you make a decision like that doesn't justify us investing more to help reduce that a certain small percentage. We're good with where it is right now.
Yeah, I think that's the piece as well, right? So if you've got an enormous tail risk, right, and it's out into some, you've got some big maximum value, but the actually percentage loss is very small, it really isn't worth spending a lot of time bringing that down. Where you'd be better off focusing your spend is on the aggregate risk, right? The expectation value or the mean value all means the same thing, right? It's where your risk is concentrated and work on that. And if you're okay with that level of risk, then it's time to spend the money somewhere else.
Good point. So any advice to our IT leaders who go in every quarter, they end up spending that board, and then sometimes they have in the past and may have been leaning on too much fear. Potentially the
job. I would say quantify this, right? You know, you don't know the distribution of losses to some extent, but you can take a guess, at least as a first pass, right? If you don't have people who are comfortable doing the math themselves, go off and buy a tool to do it, right? Then test out that the tool works with some known data. Once you've done that, make some decent estimates and then have a look at the risk distribution, right? And see if you're comfortable with that. If not, then it's time to either change your processes. I mean, we've talked about tools, right? But as much as anything else, it's processes. So you might well want to change your processes to reduce your risk profile in certain areas. processes culturally, they're harder, but you can do them without capital spend as well. So that's a nicer piece, right? So it may well be that once you've got some insight into how your risks are distributed, you can start to think about how to tackle them to bring them into a kind of state that you're more comfortable with.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, right? Because I think as technology people are focused on more acquisition of new tech, as opposed to a lot of the business the ability to change process, policy, redeploy personnel, change tactics. There's a lot of options that the business has at the fingertips to help adjust that level of risk without buying something new.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of excitement. People like buying new things, right? Because it's shiny. It's also something that it's easy to report on, right? So in this quarter, we bought this new tool to do whatever, right? Whereas a process change actually might be better. Something like, the use of passwords, right? And some constraints on the use of passwords. Something like that is not as flashy, right? But having a policy like that actually might make more of a difference. So that's a cultural thing as much as anything else, right? And you've got to be comfortable with trading these kind of process changes versus purchase. Frankly, I would have a look at process first. I think that's more likely to yield results than buying new tools, especially as there's just so many vendors out there trying to sell you all kinds of things, right? If you go out to the marketplace right now, you could spend an awful lot of time. And that's why it's worth doing the risk assessment process, right? You find out where the risks are and what you might need to do to reduce them.
And that's critical, right? So if you have the top scenarios that affect the business the most, if you instinctively think this is our crown jewels, or this is a process that's critical to our business to have to stay up. And if you go over to your SOC and find out, hey, we have too many alerts coming in, you could actually focus the SOC and analysts on alerts related to systems tied to that business service or business process then.
Yeah, that's what I said at the beginning, right? I've heard CISOs. I was at a talk given by a CISO in a large hospital in the Boston area. And they were saying that they've got a number of different systems, right? Some of them are business critical and some of them aren't. Some of them aren't even connected to the internet, right? So when they get these internal scans that say, you've got this critical CVE on a system, right? It's a high priority alert. They can actually afford to leave that for a while. And then the other thing with some of these systems is that they can't be taken down during the day, right? Because they're treating patients, right? So they've got to be dealt with in the middle of the night. So that it's more complicated what you have to do, and just acting on a series of red alerts isn't helpful, right? So again, some kind of internal risk assessment. And in fact, what these guys had done is they'd categorized their systems into various risk categories, right, for the organization. And even if they got high priority alerts, they would downscale it based on, basically how important the system was to them.
And so a lot of companies know struggle with this, especially where business continuity kind of got a little stale when we started to migrate a lot of the on-prem workloads to the cloud. Yeah, they didn't catch up as much. And some of the mappings of what business service maps to which technical resources and infrastructure may not have kept up. But the question always is, which business service should I bring back up first, which has the most impact on revenue versus trying to bring everything up haphazardly?
So, yeah, that's what these guys were saying. It's a version of that, right? So you've got to understand what the critical systems are and the order in which you do it. And they've gone through this big audit, right? Which is an expensive, right? Time consuming. And of course, it's an ongoing thing because they're continually finding systems that they didn't know. Right. You know, the people up and you've also got this issue of shadow IT going on as well. Right. So that's one of the important pieces is to have that audit that tells you which are your most important systems. And it's not one and done. Right. These things change dynamically through the year. So in terms of audit, you're running this balance right between needing to continually know which are the important systems and the cost of the audit. So, I can see people why people settle on an annual audit, right? It's just too expensive to do it any other way.
So there's this concept, especially around enterprise architecture, is almost kind of a mantra of if the business spent a dollar to buy it, the tech, or pay for the people to support the tech, the developers, the analysts, the engineers, the architects, we're doing it very specifically for a business purpose. And in some sense, you're almost thinking about a business that's in operations for decades or 20 years, it's almost the CIO's and IT leadership responsibility to say the dollars that are being spent on infrastructure, we know what business aspect it supports. We know what services supports.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of times where it's a manual diagramming process. Things are moving so fast. They're not exactly sure. Is it a container in Azure or something in your data center or where all these pieces move? So let's talk about this almost like up-leveling the expectation that the business should have of IT is make sure you can map back to what we're giving you money for to what the, how it helps to support the business itself.
Right. Yeah. And there's some complicated issues here. Actually, you triggered me when you talked about businesses that have been around for a couple of decades. If you look at what happened to the British Library a little while back, right, there was a large scale ransomware attack, right? And as a public body, they have committed to publicizing what went on and their response to it. Now, reading through some of the diagnosis of what went wrong shed some lights on what you were saying. Look, I mean, the British Library had some systems which were decades old, right? And they'd gone through that risk analysis process and they realized that they were vulnerable, but there just wasn't the budget to fix them. And they thought that they were, they weren't that critical and it would be okay. But of course, the ransomware attackers attacked those systems as much as anything else and took them down, right? So it turns out that that initial analysis of what was important and what wasn't was off, right? And it's taken the British Library months, literally months, to bring its services back up, right? And they still got an open question about what to do with some of these legacy systems that they've got from decades ago. Now, that's not every company, but a lot of companies will be running software that's very old, maybe not supported. And the question is, they know they can port off it to something else, but is the budget there to do it? Right. So as you run through these kind of risk assessment processes, right, you end up with these kind of results and the business has to make a decision about what to do. Right. Because it might be in the British Library's case, it was just considered to be too expensive to port these systems, right, to go to something new. That may well be the case for some of the systems other businesses are running. Right. Yeah. And you've got to, you know, if you go to the CTO and whatever or the CFO and say, right, well, we've got this theoretical risk of this system. I know it's 10 years old and we've been using it for ages, but we'd like to spend a couple of $100,000 upgrading it. That's going to be a hard case, right? It's going to be hard to make the case that you do need to make that upgrade.
I guess another one could argue, though, even without asking for more money, the risk analysis is dependent on the CTO, CIO knowing that the legacy system exists.
Yes.
And it plugs into some new modern API with a mobile front end. So even without asking money is I'm analyzing current state in a situation where IT is telling me they don't actually know there's that middleware there. They don't know the API is there. And they didn't know this system ran COBOL. Right. So I guess actually having an accurate picture of what the technology infrastructure is almost kind of something that the business should be mandating. That let's stop getting surprised that it's there before you even ask for money for something. I may say no to the upgrade, but I can only analyze risk if I know that the systems are there and this is how it connects and supports the business.
Yeah. So that's a good question, right? And it's about identifying systems. And that's been a perennial problem, right? And that's why people have bought these tools to do internal scanning so that they can figure out what's actually connected and what isn't. And if you look at external vendors, right, have looked at people's what they call the attack surface, right, and gone back to companies, and there's been a discussion about, I'm not using this IP, I'm not using this web address, blah blah blah, and it turns out that they are, right. These are systems that you've talked about, right, that they've been forgotten about, and I've heard some wild stories about systems that have been running for years. Locked away in a closet that everybody's forgotten about, right? And everybody's heard those horror stories. But I think a lot of companies have this shadow IT going on, right? And it's gone on for a very long time, right? With people buying systems, off budget. I've heard of stories of people who, I mean, this is a years ago story, but that they bought a computer system and they called it a filing cabinet. Right? Yeah. Because they didn't want to go through their IT department, right? So in a sense, they've established their own little mini IT system, right? So in bigger organizations, that kind of stuff happens all the time. There are also external dependencies as well, especially with AI, right? People using things like OpenAI and Claude and all these other products, right, on their desktop, which have now effectively become part of the development process. They are harder to audit, right? Because they're not, these kind of cloud services that people use on their desktops and don't announce are shadow IT. They're harder to audit, but they have become part of the development process now. So your point about discovering systems, it's a difficult one. It's an ongoing challenge. And I think organizations have to admit that they're not going to get 100% of all of the systems, right? They just have to keep monitoring all the time and just accept that they're not going to get everything.
Yeah, and that's kind of a hard pill to take for a system architect. Yeah. Like I got a system that we invested money in. I have IT personnel that we've hired. We got these monitoring tools. But if I have to go back in front of the business, say, we don't actually understand exactly how the system works, like what allows this car plant to work or this payment system to work or e-commerce. But do you know who does do great discovery? Mm-hmm. The adversaries.
Yeah.
They'll map out your infrastructure. They'll map out where your critical systems, your data is, how much insurance they think you have. They'll read your policy, just how much we can encrypt the data. They do a very good job in a short period of time when they're focused, which is an interesting, I guess, commentary on us. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So I think there are two things to cope with that, right? So one is internal scanning that we've talked about. The other one is external scanning. And the problem with external scanning is the false positives, right? Right. So long as you expect that, and I wouldn't do this every day with external scans, but every so often have a look at, see what external scans actually show up. And then just go and track these things down, right? So again, it's an external scan might show you that there's a particular IP address that one of your systems is using that you may have not been aware of, right? And I've heard of this, again, these stories of people tracking these systems down. That's an internal scan might not show everything. And that's why it needs to be coupled with an external scan as well.
And the truth, right? So if your architects put up 10 systems, my expectation is you remember there are 10 systems running the service. And in some cases, IT loses track of that because of lack of quality in the process of inventory and architecture. And this, I think there's an opportunity for IT to get better at this. I'm okay with maybe something new popping up very quickly. If I've been running an e-commerce site with 10 systems for the last 3 years and IT comes back to me, like the COO or CTO, and say, we lost track of system number 10. We forgot it was there and we didn't patch it. The only reason we didn't patch it, because we forgot it was there. And that almost becomes like, whoa, that's your responsibility. I couldn't tell a CFO, the CFO forgot that he had 4 additional suppliers he had to go pay. And the suppliers called and said, how can you get you guys and pay me? And the CFO says, well, we have too many suppliers, we forgot to pay you. That would never run in a...
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, right? And the other thing that with the advent of cloud services, right? That is, it's become very easy to spin up a service to do things, right? And I've heard of developers and other people spinning up services, you know, to have a go and investigate something without telling IT, right? So you sometimes have these systems that exist, or maybe they're being paid out of like the filing cabinet budget or whatever it is, right? And that people don't want to admit to, right? Or they've just forgotten to tell IT. And you're quite right. This is IT's job to know. But it's a very difficult position, right? That's why I was talking about the internal and external scans. And with all of these things, you have to accept the false positives, right? There really is no way around it.
Yeah. So this brought us a very interesting conversation. So if you wanted to kind of leave some parting thoughts to IT leaders, right? So they see the complexity inside the environment. They're looking at what's in the news and the market, noise and disruptions. And they're looking to help be a better business partner to the stakeholders. Any recommendations or things where they can help focus in or make improvements?
Yeah, so it's the strategic piece, right? And I think often security people are very operational, right? So it's a step up from the help desk. And I'm not sure I'm going to irritate people by saying that, right? But you know that something's flagged up, a CV's flagged up, so off they go with a toolkit and they go up and cure the system, right? That's a very low level operational piece, right? Instead, I think they need to focus on the more strategic level, and as you said, right, they need to understand what systems are there, they need to understand what risks, And, you know, sometimes you get it wrong. In the British Library's case, right, they made an assessment that the cost of updating these systems was too high, the risk was low, and it turned out to be wrong. But at least they've made an informed decision, right, about what to do. So I think that for leaders, CISOs and others, they need to operate at that strategic level, right? They have to understand what the systems are there. They have to understand the constraints that they're under. They have to understand it's a gray area. And they need to be honest with their stakeholders to say that, look, all of this stuff is going on and it might actually be good for the business, right, to have shadow IT and do these bits and pieces. But it's a risk, right? And we have to accept this. And what we do have to do is control the core and allow some stuff at the edges, but we also need the tools to do that. And then the other piece is to understand the risk that they're running. Now, and that's where, you know, risk quantification comes in. And for all of its flaws, at least it gives you a sense of putting some numbers on this strategically, right? Especially as times are getting tighter now, right? If you're going to go off and try and buy a $50,000 tool, or you want to make some process change that's going to cost people's time and effort, you have to make the case for it. And that comes down to saying, well, can you quantify the risk? There's a lot of management talk, and has been for the last 20 years, about quantifying everything, quantifying the benefit, quantifying the effort, whatever. However they do it, security people absolutely have to start quantifying things. And that means moving away from this lower level work to much more higher strategic work about thinking about the organization as a whole and quantifying those risks.
So fantastic. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention before we close out?
I mean, the only thing is the impact of AI, which is probably worth a conversation in itself. Okay. But what I will say about the impact of AI is that look, it can make things worse, right? Because it can flag up more false positives and more bits and pieces. A lot of people are touting tools and they tell you that they've got AI or it used to be ML, but now they've decided, you know, the same thing they've decided to call AI. Doesn't matter that these things have AIs, it's irrelevant, right? All that matters at the end of the day is what it can do for you and the results of the tool, right? So ignore, you know, it's like basically a sports car, right? Yeah. You know, you care how fast it can go, but the fact that it has Goodyear tires or Michelin tires is really kind of largely irrelevant. So focus on these things of what they can do. Ignore the hype around AI, right? Because AI tools can sometimes make things worse, and just focus on value for money and the impact that this tool has on risk reduction.
Fantastic, Mike. So you're definitely right. The AI one could be an entire show by itself.
Yeah.
But I think we've done a fantastic job on this whole kind of this risk management, kind of state of affairs, and how we help improve our ability to communicate with the business and give them the things they can use, potentially leveraging risk quantification and some other tooling.
Yes.
So
yeah,
I think this has been fantastic, man.
Cheers. Thank you very much, William.
I appreciate your time today. All right, we're going to sign off now. And okay. That's been another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. See you next time.
Thanks for joining another episode of the Smart IT Podcast, where we explore what's next for IT and disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk together. If you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, and leave your comments. And for more Smart IT wisdom, check out my website at williamreed.info.